Staring at the color security monitor, Quisado watched the deadly American racing toward his office, presumably moving in for the kill. A twinge of fear shot through him, but died an instant later. He didn't care how many people the man burned through before finally reaching him. Quisado still knew he'd walk away from this unscathed. He scanned the room and saw 10 of his best gunners lining up, weapons charged, ready to a man to heap punishment on this arrogant bastard. Another carload of hardmen was speeding across town right now to cover his back. And if it came to a showdown, the former Iraqi soldier knew he'd handle this SOB just as he had so many others. Just because he was the boss now didn't mean he didn't know how to get his hands dirty. Shrugging off his jacket, he folded it and placed it over the back of a couch. He checked the weapons he carried. A pair of 10mm Colt Delta Elites. One in a shoulder rig, the second on his hip in a fast draw holster. Cortez, his eyes bloodshot and puffy, marched up to him.
It's definitely him. The guy from Colorado, I mean.
Thanks for leaving him here.
Shove it! I didn't mean for this to happen.
And yet, you succeeded brilliantly.
The Mexican tapped the barrel of his Ithaca pump shotgun against his boot, as though he were considering something. Quisado knew where the man's mind was wandering.
Don't think about it. You might get me, but my people will get you. I've got the money to pay them. You don't.
No worries. Right now, you're worth more to me alive than dead. But just remember, I've got your fucking number, amigo. These dim bastards might think you're about to make your last stand here, but we both know better, don't we? Why take a bullet when you can make money, right?
Your point.
When you decide to run, you take me with you. Otherwise, I'll shoot you in the damn back.
Done.
Rabin moved on to the second floor, intending to head for Quisado's office. This big blonde man in a leather jacket was trying to bag Quisado, the man she'd come to kill, and she wasn't about to surrender her prize so easily. Rabin hugged the walls and crept toward the action. Her palm felt moist against the textured grip of her handgun, but her breath came steadily and easily. Her eyes narrowed as she scanned the corridor up ahead, trying to size up the situation. The floor was littered with bodies. The hulking man charged toward Quisado's office. He moved with a speed and grace that seemed impossible for a man of his size. Rabin fell in behind him, albeit at a more cautious pace. The hallway stank of gun smoke, and a whitish haze made it difficult to see ahead. She watched as he stopped outside Quisado's door and studied it for a moment. She came up behind him, her pistol poised in front of her in a two-handed grip. She got within 20 feet or so.
Stop!
He whirled toward her, his handgun coming around too. When he saw that she had an easy shot at him, he froze. He made no move to surrender his weapon.
Step away from there!
Forget it, lady. I've come too far to do that.
I'll shoot!
I can tell you'll shoot. You one of Quisado's people?
Go to hell. Put your gun down, I swear I'll kill you.
If you're one of his people, you'd be better off to do it. I'm going in.
Damn it, I'm not!
Something about the man gave her pause. It was possible that they were working at cross purposes, but maybe not.
I'm an American. I'm here for Quisado. I'm not leaving without him. If you're a local cop or something, I suggest you get out of here. This is way bigger than you or me, and I have no choice but to keep going ahead.
I'm here for him too.
Well, we can't flip a damn coin for it. If you want him, you're gonna have to shoot me in the...
He stopped speaking and his eyes flicked over her shoulder.
Watch out!
Rabin felt a searing pain lance through her shoulder and kidney. An unseen force propelled her forward. Had the American shot her? A glance told her that he was just bringing up his gun. He charged toward her, one arm out, to catch her. She sank to her knees. He knelt next to her, and she was vaguely aware of his arm encircling her waist. Her shoulder pressed into him, his body the only thing supporting her. To her surprise, the burning points of pain seemed to fade, along with the noise. She closed her eyes, and blackness overcame her.
Yeah!
The shooter didn't wait for the woman to die before he made a play for Lyons. The guy whipped toward the ABLE team leader and the Israeli woman. Lyons caught the woman as she fell. Two more gunners were silhouetted behind the man. Lyons drew a bead on the thug to his right, a burst hammering the man's abdomen. Safe for the moment, Lyons saw three neat holes lined up diagonally along the woman's back. He rolled her onto her stomach and found the exiting bullets had torn gaping exit wounds on the front of her body. He stood and forced his attention back to getting into Quisad's office. A deadbolt clicked back behind him, and Lyons spun. Several of Quisad's hard men had emptied into the hallway, gun muzzles tracking him. Lyons fisted the python from beneath his jacket and made a do-or-die play. Quisad let his people pour into the hallway. He wanted them to form a human wall between him and the American. With his escape covered, Quisad made a run for the stairwell door. A quick look over his shoulder told him that Cortez followed only a couple of steps behind. If he could get to the parking garage below, he'd slip into his BMW. That'd buy him time to get out of the city and eventually the country, with the cold earth worm still in his possession. Once he gained a little breathing room, he could figure out his next move. Taking two steps at a time, he raced down the first flight of stairs. When he reached the landing, he felt someone grab him by his shirt collar and stop him. He whipped around. The sudden motion ripped his collar free of Cortez's grip. The Mexican's arm was raised up over his head. Apparently, Quisad realized his face betrayed his surprise because a smile ghosted Cortez's lips as his arm arced downward. When the Iraqi crumpled to the floor, Cortez gave a vicious smile. He felt fragile bones give against his steel-toed boots. It all felt so good. He couldn't help but kick the bastard one last time. As he stood over his partner, he stared at him and shook his head in pity.
Sorry, my friend. It's survival of the fittest, and you're not fit to breathe the same air as me. So I'll sacrifice you to our pursuers. In the meantime, I must leave.
Cortez knelt next to the fallen man and searched Quisad's pockets until he found the keys. Should he take the man's weapons and leave him unarmed? The thought of the Iraqi injured and unarmed facing off against the two Americans pleased Cortez, but he decided against it. In the unlikely event that they made it through the wall of hard men upstairs, Cortez wanted Quisad armed, if only so he could attempt a last stand and delay them. During his search, Cortez also found the mini-disc. He weighed it in his palm for a moment and considered his next move. If he took it with him, there was a chance, perhaps a small chance, that he could sell it. But if they'd identified him, they knew all his aliases, all his underworld contacts. There was an equally good chance that by the time he was able to stop running, the disc would be useless, either too hot to touch or already outmoded. But if he no longer had it, their interest in him might wane. He tossed the disc onto the floor next to Quisad and scrambled down the stairs. David McCarter dropped into a crouch and grabbed an HE grenade from his gear. McCarter rose from the floor and surged toward the wall of flame and smoke ahead. Slowly, he moved into the kill zone and found four of Farnsworth's thugs on the floor. The injuries three had suffered were obviously fatal. A fourth man was balled up on the floor, flesh and fabric shredded or burned by the explosion. The Briton placed a mercy round into the man's head and continued on. Farnsworth watched the battle unfold on the security monitors. A warrior himself, he had to respect these bastards tearing apart his stronghold, but he couldn't let their blitz continue unabated. He hadn't come this far to die, or to walk away without something to show for his efforts. He turned to Mace, who watched the proceedings with a stony expression. If the wholesale slaughter of his men bothered the man, he didn't let it show.
How many have we lost?
At least a couple dozen. Probably more. Casualty counts continue to come in, but I'd be a damn fool to vouch for their accuracy. We've got too much going on to get a good count. We got people pinned down where we can't get to them. These SOBs have cut a bloody swath through my people.
So send more.
Not sure I have many more to send.
Do it. Make sure to send our little package, too.
Our little... What? Are you out of your damn mind?
Mace, which part of the command didn't you understand?
But if we stick them now, we won't get the money.
Oh, get a grip. If they were going to pay the money, we wouldn't be overrun with commandos right now, would we?
Mace's lips tightened into a bloodless line, and his jaw muscles rippled. Farnsworth met the other man's steely gaze with one of his own and waited for the bastard to remember his place.
We can't pack it in now. We put too much into this to give up.
Who said anything about packing it in? I'm not going to lose. I may not get my money, but I'm not going to let these bastards in Washington think they put one over on me again. I'm going to start a series of nuclear meltdowns that will hobble the United States for the next damn millennium. I'll teach these bastards a lesson, and by God, I will enjoy it. When this is all over, they'll know better than to screw with Dale Farnsworth. They'll know who won and who lost. And if you don't have the stones to call out the order, I'll do it myself.
But what about...
Oh, get the hell out of here. I'll handle it.
Mace spun on a heel and marched from the control room. Farnsworth watched after him for a moment, and a smile formed on his lips while he did. Idiot, he thought. When it came to scoring a hefty ransom, the game was over. At this point, it was time to make it out with his skin intact. And if he got to hand down a little payback to the United States, maybe world capitals like Moscow, Beijing, or Tel Aviv in the process, so much the better. Mace stormed into the bunker's control room. A sandy-haired mercenary was seated at a console that controlled security cameras and sensors, handled all internal and external communications and other security features such as elevators and doors. He turned away from his work and gave Mace an expectant look.
Drop the damn doors. If they get any closer to the hub, I'll rip off your skull and lob it at them.
The gunner swallowed hard and nodded his agreement. His fingers flew over the console as he worked. In the meantime, Mace glanced over the security monitors and watched the commandos cut through more of his men with relative ease. Some of the best mercenaries in the world, he thought, and they're getting their heads handed to them. Who are these people? The security man pointed at the third monitor to the right. It depicted a slender, foxed-faced man making his way through one of the corridors leading to the main hub where they were located.
This one here? He took out four of our guys with a grenade. I dispatched four more people to his position.
Mace checked the load on his Heckler & Koch UMP.
I'm going too. In the meantime, start punching some buttons. We're going code alpha.
Shit!
Yeah, shit. It's time to unleash a nuclear holocaust or two. Do it!
No, I mean, shit! The network just went down. Every last bit of it.
What? What the hell do you mean it's down? We need to send out that damn worm, and we need to do it now.
I'm fucking locked out. It looked like we got hit with the virus, but how?
Mace remembered the attached file he'd opened earlier, and a thrill of fear raced through him. He'd done this. Now, he had to fix it. McCarter got a bad feeling in his gut as he wound his way along the corridor. Using his stolen key card, he checked three doors and came up with nothing. That he'd found no sign yet of Fox was bad news, he thought. If he recalled the floor plan provided by the farm correctly, he'd soon reach what had been a primary research lab for the defunct nuclear project. The corridor straightened, then jogged right. Reaching a corner, he peered around it and saw a handful of Farnsworth's gunners positioned behind sandbags. He pulled back, let his weapon fall slack on its strap, and palmed an M451 stun grenade from his satchel. While the mercenaries found themselves stricken by sound and fury, McCarter surged toward their position, M4 in hand. One soldier stood, his palms pressed against his eyes. A second man slapped at a spot where multiple sparks had seared his flesh. The Phoenix Force leader surged toward the gunner's position, even as he rammed a fresh clip into his assault rifle. He found all four hard men sprawled about, their fatigues tattered and soaked with blood. Beyond the sandbag barricade lay a single steel door. He vaulted over the trashed sandbags and headed for it. A swipe of the keycard granted him entry. He looked inside, and his lip curled into a snarl. Another damned corridor. He traded out the M4 for the twin Browning high powers he carried on his hips. The corridor stretched a little more than 5 yards before he came upon a second door. He tried unsuccessfully to open the door with his keycard. It didn't respond.
Bloody lovely.
Time to frisk the corpses, he thought. Surely one of them had an access card. McCarter turned and froze. A bulky silhouette stood in the door. He couldn't make out the man's face, but the shape of a weapon pointed in his direction was unmistakable.
Drop the damn guns.
Bloody lovely.
Blancanalis stepped into the main bar area on the club's ground floor. Scanning the room for danger, he found none. At least, nothing obvious. He wound his way between the overturned chairs and tables that covered the floor. Wisps of gun smoke hung in the air. Reaching the stairwell, he surged up the steps, taking them two at a time. He held the MP5 ahead of him, muscles and nerves tensed to react as he waded into another gun battle. When he reached the top, he dropped into a crouch and spotted Lyons. The ABLE team leader had taken cover in a door and firing two handguns in unison at a wall of killers. The shooters unloaded their weapons in Lyons' direction, bullets tearing through his sports jacket and chewing into the floor in front of him. Blancanalis knew his old friend was putting up one hell of a fight. He also knew the guy's luck was probably a heartbeat away from running out. Too many killers, too few bullets. He cut loose with the MP5. Lyons' head whipped toward his teammate. The skin of his face was ruddy and his eyes reflected his rage like a cornered grizzly bear. When he identified his benefactor as Blancanalis, he shot him a wink. Blancanalis set the shotgun on the floor and kicked it toward Lyons. Then he turned back to his deadly work. He caught one guy trying to draw a bead on him with a pair of micro Uzis. Blancanalis whipped around the MP5 and burned through the rest of the clip. The ABLE team commando crouched at the knees, ejected the SMG's magazine, and grabbed another from his combat webbing. When he looked up, he saw a big goateed man tracking his movements with a handgun. He glanced left and saw Lyons lining up another shot with a shotgun. Blancanalis raked the MP5 from right to left in a figure eight and took out three more gunners. A blur of movement registered in the corner of Blancanalis' eye. He pivoted to the right and brought up his SMG. He spotted Khan, eyes bugged out, sweat-soaked shirt matted to his body, darting into the corridor. The guy had a pistol in each hand and was leveling them at the ABLE team warriors. Moving in unison, Blancanalis and Lyons drew down on him.
Well, that's one for the books.
They killed a woman.
What? Where?
Behind us. She came to take out Quisad. What she got was a bullet. One meant for me.
We'll get him.
You're damn right we will. Follow me.
When he reached an exit door, he peered through the small rectangular window looking in on the stairwell. The landing was empty. No big surprise there. He didn't expect Quisad or Cortez to wait around for a final showdown. He guessed both had already fled the building.
Cover me.
You got it.
Holding the shotgun by its pistol grip, he pointed the muzzle skyward and hit the release bar on the door. The weapon was steadied for one-handed shooting by a stock that fit over the wrist. Lyons peered over the railing, but the stretch of stairs visible to him looked clear. Moving silently and swiftly, he descended the first flight of stairs, then the second, and reached the first floor landing. He noticed a dark patch of something on the floor, glistening because of the overhead lights. He pointed it out to Blancanalis, who acknowledged it with a nod. Before Lyons could take another step, he heard it. The shotgun held in front of him, he started for the basement. Quisad felt the tempo of his heart increase, heard blood roar in his ears as he tried to open the exit door, but found it locked. He gave the door's release bar one last push, but it still refused to give. Quisad wheeled and grabbed for his Delta Elite handguns. The gun dealer waited several seconds for some indication of what was coming. He forced his breathing to slow as a wave of fear threatened to overtake him. Pointing the twin Deltas up the stairs, he saw shadows shifting on the wall of the landing above him. Part of him wanted to call out. Surely that damned American hadn't plowed through all those guards, he thought. It wasn't possible. But what if he had? If the man who set off the explosion in the basement had made it upstairs, it was possible the two commandos had made it through the wall of killers he'd left behind. Forget it, he thought. He was going to take them down. Once they came into view, he was going to unload both deltas into them before they could spot him. If it turned out that he'd killed his own people, so be it. Once he got back on his feet, maybe he'd send their families a check. Maybe. In the meantime, he wanted to get out with his own skin intact, which meant it was time for scorched earth tactics. Quisad's heart jumped as he realized what he had done. He revealed his presence as clearly as shouting. He still couldn't see anyone, but he knew that was to be expected. They likely were hugging the opposite wall, trying to circle around as widely as possible to keep him from spotting them prematurely. He moved right and flattened against the wall. The deltas remained locked at a 45-degree angle, ready to deal death on whoever blundered into his sights. Lyons hit the landing but stayed close to the wall, trying to keep himself out of the line of sight of whoever stood at the bottom of the stairs. Blancanellis arrived a step or two behind his teammate. He turned, aimed his MP5 skyward, and scanned their six for potential attackers. When he pivoted back toward Lyons, the former LA cop pointed toward the final flight of stairs and tapped his chest with the tip of his thumb. Blancanellis nodded. Lyons held up a thumb and two fingers, indicating a three count, and received another nod. He curled them in rapid succession, counting down to the deadly play. When he hit three, he surged toward the stairwell, the shotgun held at shoulder height. As he reached the precipice, flashes exploded from below. Bullets sizzled past him. In a heartbeat, he saw Quisad, his enraged features illuminated by the muzzle flashes. The buckshot tore into the Iraqi's chest, ripping the flesh like dozens of ravenous piranhas. Force from the blast punched him backward until he collided with the door behind him. As the echoes subsided, Quisad's corpse slowly slid to the floor. Nearly 2 hours later, Lyons stood outside the club, a foam cup of hot coffee clutched in his hands. Fire trucks, ambulances, and police cars were parked outside the building, red and blue lights whipping across its facade. When the police had stormed the building, the two commandos had surrendered themselves and their weapons. The inspector they'd met upon arriving in Prague immediately had washed his hands of the pair and had referred all questions to his superiors, as well as Hal Brugnola. The police had cleared them about 20 minutes earlier. Blancanellis had spent the last several minutes probing for information about Cortez.
What's the word?
He's gone. He just disappeared.
On foot or by car?
Car. At least that's the theory. The forensics guys searched Quisad's body but found no keys. His BMW is missing. The police said they're looking for the car even as we speak.
I guess that means we turn the town upside down and start hunting Cortez.
Not immediately, amigo.
What? Why the hell not?
I talked to Hal a few minutes ago. For the moment, he says the hell with Cortez. He's more worried about a well-heeled group of vengeful Baathists trying to buy weapons than he is about Cortez. Plus, Hal considers him less of an immediate danger, since he doesn't appear to have the disc in his possession.
We've got to nail this SOB for what he did to Gadgets, right? If we don't move now, we lose him.
Hal's going to ask the locals to issue an all-points bulletin on the guy. They'll monitor the borders, the airports, all the usual entry and exit points. If anyone finds Cortez, they'll be asked to arrest and extradite him to the United States. Or, if we're lucky, they'll contain him so that we can pick him up ourselves.
World's a big place. Could be years before we locate him. Besides, we don't have extradition treaties with everyone.
Hal swears that there's a good chance of tracking this guy down. Cortez has bank accounts in the Cayman Islands and Switzerland. Hal asked the Treasury to hunt them down and track them. To help expedite matters, the man is going to make a personal appeal to those governments to cooperate. In the meantime, the Mexican government has coughed up his known aliases, along with any credit card or bank accounts held under those names. The guy's got to eat. He's got to put a roof over his head. It's only a matter of time before he messes up.
I've got half a mind to tell Hal to stuff it. Who needs all this bureaucratic nonsense?
See you in the unemployment line.
Damn it!
Seriously, Hal's doing what he can. After all the carnage we caused tonight, we are not exactly welcome here. And with the big picture threat diffused, at least on our side, Hal's getting pressure from the locals to get us the hell out of Dodge. He doesn't like it any better than we do. But it beats the hell out of kicking us out of the country, arresting us, or putting us into protective custody. So Hal thinks we are to get while the getting is good.
Damn bureaucrats. All right, let's go. Hal sound pissed at least?
Yeah.
Great. At least something good came out of this. Maybe I ought to put some ketchup on my ass before he chews it off.
Colorful, Carl. Very colorful.
Bending slowly at the knees, David McCarter set the Browning on the floor and stood back, his hands raised. He kept his eyes locked on the gun-wielding thug next to him the whole time. Jack Mace gave him a wide smile, lips peeling back to reveal nicotine-stained teeth. The gun muzzle remained locked on the Briton's chest.
At least you're pleased with yourself.
A Brit? Well, I'll be damned. I figured it was the Americans coming in to bust up our little party, but it's the goddamn Brits.
McCarter remained silent. After a couple of stretched seconds, the guy jabbed the H&K's muzzle under the commando's chin and pushed up, forcing McCarter to tilt his head uncomfortably.
Give me some answers, now, before I splatter your friggin' head all over this room. And believe me, I'd like nothing better after the shit you put us through.
And I'll save you the anticipation. I'm not saying shit, so pull a trigger.
McCarter turned his head right and saw Gabriel Fox's head moving slightly, the fingers of his right hand curling. McCarter had almost made it.
Well, I'll be damned. Looks like our pet geek's waking up. I don't suppose you SOBs came all this way, spilled all this blood to rescue that little piece of shit, did you?
I've no idea who he is. And if you want anything more than name, rank, and serial number, you can go to hell.
You got some brass ones on you. I'll give you that.
Mace stepped back, raised the UMP with one hand, pointed it to McCarter's temple. The Briton felt his heart hammer in his chest, heard blood roar in his ears. His mind raced for a solution, a way out of this deadly situation, but he came up blank. Suddenly, everything blurred. He saw the gunner's head whip right, his lip curling into a snarl. The gun's muzzle strayed from McCarter's temple. Mace was moving it to target someone else.
Down!
Something warm and wet had splattered onto the side of McCarter's face, making him wince. The Briton turned to see Hawkins standing over the body, holding his M60, barrel smoking. When he spotted McCarter, his face screwed up in mock disgust.
Damn, son. That's not your color.
Shut and chaw my ass.
Coming to his full height, McCarter pulled his shirt tail to his face and wiped it off. He advanced next to Fox and knelt next to him, eyeing him for open wounds. Seeing none, he grabbed him by the shoulder and rolled him onto his back. McCarter shook his head. The guy's face and neck were a mess of purplish bruises, red welts, scrapes, and deep gashes. He scanned him for gunshot or stab wounds, but found nothing. Peeling back Fox's t-shirt, he found his mushroom-white torso also covered in bruises and welts.
Bastards did a number on him. He could have internal injuries, but he needs to be examined before we'll know for sure.
McCarter activated his comlink.
This is David DeBob. Mission accomplished.
That's excellent. We'll send a Black Hawk in to bring you folks out.
Great. We'll take our young friend topside.
What about Farnsworth?
Still among the living. We're trying to change that.
Moving with wraith-like silence, Farnsworth ascended the stairs leading to the first floor, his eyes darting around wildly, scanning his surroundings for threats. Sweat slicked his forehead in the area between his shoulder blades. His breaths came fast and shallow. Sneaking up from the second level had been easy enough. Though he had heard gunfire near his quarters, he'd seen no one in the corridor when he made his way to the stairwell. The way he figured it, that meant the dead were piling up elsewhere, which suited him fine. He didn't mind blood spilling, as long as it wasn't his own. Reaching the first level, he slipped through the door and advanced down the hallway toward the elevator leading to the ground level. When he came within a few yards of the door, he hit the button and waited for the car to arrive. An uncomfortable sensation, the feeling of impending danger, prompted him to whirl around. A fierce-looking man with dark blonde hair exited a nearby hallway. His gun flew up, muzzle trying to home in on Farnsworth.
No!
Streams of fire lashed out at the unidentified commando, driving him to the ground.
Come on.
Come on! Come on! Oh!
He leaned back against the wall, mopping the sweat from his forehead with his shirt sleeve. The doors parted, and Farnsworth darted from the car into the small building that housed the elevator. He cut a path straight toward the door. Rocketing outside, his eyes squinting hard against the sudden overload of natural light, but he still broke into a run, legs pumping, chewing through the 75 yards that separated him from the motor pool. Within seconds, a vehicle lay just within reach, maybe a dozen or so yards away.
Stop!
Farnsworth ignored the voice, hurtling into the space between the lines of trucks and sport utility vehicles, grateful for the cover they provided. He reached a truck, a monster with a V8 engine and spare fuel tanks, opened the door, and climbed inside. He glanced out the window and saw a pair of armed men sprinting toward him. It didn't matter now. He was home free.
See you in hell!
Manning stopped running, reached into his pocket, and withdrew a detonator. He thumbed the first toggle into position, followed by two more.
See you in hell, Farnsworth.
Truck and SUV carcasses, tons of mangled steel, interiors ablaze, were catapulted into the air, where they flipped and fell back to the earth. Columns of black-tinged hellfire writhed as they choked the skies with black, oily smoke. Manning watched raging flames consume the vehicles and the garages. Enciso raced up next to him.
Which car was hit?
That one.
Ooh.
Now that...
had to hurt. Yeah.
Milan, Italy.
We will not lose our heads. We have a goal, and we will not let anyone deter us from that goal.
Nasser Hakim gave Kamal Ramadan a hard stare.
We already are deterred. They've frozen all our assets. They killed two of our members in Prague, one more this morning in Berlin. The four of us in this room are all that's left of the movement. Some of the men know our money's gone. They're talking about leaving.
Ramadan leaned his forearms on the table and stared at Hakim.
If they say they're leaving, have them killed. Or better yet, do it yourself.
Hakim's mouth tightened into an angry line, but he nodded his agreement. The other two men nodded as well. Ramadan smiled and leaned back in his chair.
Remember, we are not alone. There are other countries more than willing to back us. If the Americans freeze our accounts, we'll get more. It's that simple. We will not be beaten, not this time. We must know this in our hearts as Iraqis, that one day we'll restore Ba'athist rule to our homeland. Our friends, the other members of the Seven, won't have died in vain.
More nods, this time delivered with enthusiasm, told Ramadan that he'd calmed any doubts that may have existed.
Come in. I think we're about done here.
The door opened, and he saw one of his guards standing there. The man opened his mouth to speak, but part of his stomach burst out in a spray of blood and flesh. He pitched face forward, and the Iraqi saw a vision of hell. A big man stood in the door. He was dressed head to toe in black. Combat cosmetics were smeared over his cheeks, forehead, and nose. He held a machine gun in both hands. Gabriel Fox lay in the hospital bed, tubes running into his nose and out of his arms. Copies of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal lay on his bedside table, next to a sweating plastic pitcher of ice water. He didn't bother to open any of the newspapers. All he cared about was what he'd been through during the past couple of weeks. He knew he'd find nothing about that in the papers. Or, more to the point, he'd find nothing of substance. A news brief in the Times had reported that Dale Farnsworth, an international banker, had perished when his plane went down over the Atlantic Ocean. The story claimed correctly that no body had been recovered, but it failed to mention, probably because the reporter didn't know, that the man's body had been vaporized in Africa days before. There'd been no story regarding Jack Mace's death, of course. Sure, the guy damn near had turned the world into a glowing radioactive sinkhole, but as far as most people were concerned, he was just a mercenary, and certainly not worthy of an obituary, or anyone's grief. So, for all intents and purposes, it was over. In some ways, that suited Fox just fine. He was in no mood to relive the events of the past couple of weeks. That included his wife's death, though he knew he'd never truly be free of that burden. It may lessen with time, but it wouldn't go away. Kurtzman wheeled inside. He guided his chair up next to the bed.
What are these?
O'Reilly books. Read them. You might learn something. Study hard enough and you'll be like me someday.
A dream come true.
So how's the patient doing today?
Breathing.
Well, according to the doctor, you're doing better than that. For a guy with four broken ribs, a cracked pelvis, a broken collarbone, internal bleeding, and a couple of bruised organs.
Oh, glad you guys rescued me before I got hurt. Did I mention that I hate the bastards who did this to me?
I know some guys. They can make the bad people go away for you.
So I noticed when you guys wheeled me out of the chopper. Until I blacked out again. From what I saw, your guys really play for keeps.
They have to.
I'm not complaining. Just making an observation.
My friends did leave a couple of the computer guys vertical. They brought them back to the States and turned them over to the Justice Department for interrogation. One of the guys said you put up a hell of a fight. He said that they needed tasers to take you down.
Mess with the best, die like the rest. Amazing how hard you can fight when you're not afraid to get hurt.
Or die.
Yeah.
You still feel that way? You ready to check out if you get the right opportunity?
You volunteering?
Hardly. I just wanted to know.
Nah, I'm not exactly in love with life right now. Still, I want to keep going. I figure that if I lived through the last couple of weeks, I wasn't meant to check out yet. And Maria wouldn't have wanted me to do that either. She was pretty tough. If the roles had been reversed, she wouldn't have given up. So I guess I owe it to her not to do that either.
Makes sense to me.
Speaking of dying, what happened to your buddy? The guy who took a bullet in Colorado. He doing okay?
Yeah, he's fine, but a little sore. I guess he's decided to do a little traveling.
Cayman Islands.
He could get used to living this way. Cortez smiled at the thought. He stood on the balcony of his apartment, drink in hand, staring down at a pretty woman passing by on the street below. It had been 2 weeks since the firefight in Libya. After he'd escaped the country, leaving Quisad to take a bullet, he'd arrived in Spain, fake passport in hand. He'd stolen enough money from his former boss, Mendoza, to put himself up in style here in the Caymans. And he had a friend who likely could help him tap into both Mendoza's and Quisad's black accounts. If he played things right, he'd likely end up rich enough to never have to work again. It certainly wasn't what he'd hoped for, but he'd make the best of things. The door was his signal that his night's entertainment had arrived. His smile widened, and he moved back inside his luxuriously appointed home. The past week or so had been a blur for him. After the unpleasantness in Africa, he decided he needed a nice break. He spent several $1,000s living it up in the city. Local escort services had been only too happy to provide him with all the flesh he could stand. And he'd yet to reach his threshold. Tonight he requested a redhead, and he could hardly wait to see who they'd sent him. A warm sensation spread through his loins as he headed for the front door. When he reached it, he scowled. The door was closed, but he saw no one. Perhaps she'd already headed for the bedroom. A consummate professional. He'd like that in his whores. A quick check of the bedroom yielded nothing. Uneasiness gripped him when he returned to the main room, but found it empty.
Hello? Who's there?
Sucking in a big breath, he puffed out his chest and started for the patio. With each step, his rage deepened, causing him to hurtle forth like a heat-seeking missile locked onto a fighter jet's exhaust. Whoever was playing this stupid game would be taught a lesson they wouldn't soon forget. A man stepped from inside the kitchen, a gun in his hand, and Cortez recognized him as the federal agent from Colorado, the one he'd shot from the balcony and left for dead.
I sent your girlfriend packing. I told her we had a little unfinished business to clear up.
Cortez nodded slowly while he sized the other man up.
That we do.
This time, you'd better finish me off.
Gladly.
Lightning fast, Cortez brought up his pistol, his finger tightening on the trigger. But Schwartz's Beretta was already in play.
That's how you shoot to kill, you dumb bastard.
Stony Man Hell Dawn is a Graphic Audio production. Stony Man, The Executioner, and Mac Bolan are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2006, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by James Konacek, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Richard Rowan, Sonny Lasky, James Lewis, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Adapted for Graphic Audio and directed by Dan Smith. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld and Kyle Univer. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Nathaniel Perry and Matt Webb. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and The Executioner, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Calling Cerberus. Calling Cerberus. If you receive transmission, must listen closely. Offer information in exchange for asylum. Rendezvous. Repeat. Offer information for asylum. Information Tiamat Nymph Buffer. Have info on memory buff of Tiamat.
Kane and the Cerberus Warriors have just one chance to stop a rogue overlord from making a grab for absolute power.
Behold!
We've got a skull made out of quartz crystal. Picked it up in Pakistan the day before yesterday.
Really? Oh, this is better than I hoped. Two at hand, only 11 more to go. And as fortune would have it, I know just where they are.
What was that Sindri said about 11 more skulls?
According to legends among certain South American Indian tribes, there are 13 crystal skulls in existence. These skulls represented 12 planets and were originally kept in a Mayan pyramid within a circle formation. A 13th larger crystal skull represented the collective consciousness of the 12 and was placed in the center of the circle. This circle formation of the 12 crystal skulls, with one larger crystal skull in the center, was known as the Throne of Ascension.
A skull throne, in other words.
The only mystery is how to stop Overlord Nergal from laying claim to them.
It means joining forces with a Mayan goddess and two old enemies to win a race against time for the capture or destruction of an artifact long lost in the Mayan jungle.
With them, Nergal thinks he can gain control over Tiamat's neuronic systems, her main memory core.
Is gaining control over Tiamat even possible?
The crystal skulls are data transfer interfaces with the computer systems aboard Tiamat. Much like a wireless communication network that processes electronic and telemetric signals.
And the pyramid in the city is a transmission tower. That's why Nergal has been seeking out all the skulls, so he can reactivate it.
What the hell was all of that?
Holography.
A hologram of what, though?
It looked like a Mayan pyramid. Kane and I had to fight our way out of one a few years back.
The so-called lost city of Z, or X, of Xibalba, is not just a hiding place for the Maya's sacred relics, but was also used as a remote transmission station.
The secrets of Xibalba could help secure the contested prize of planet Earth.
So, when do we go? Shit!
Outlanders number 41. Skull Throne.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.